Just like you, we're working hard to boost our direct booking strategy and reduce our dependence on Airbnb. But we were a little bit nervous about how we would verify guests who book directly with us. That's why we've started using Know Your Guest by Superhog.
Know Your Guest introduces guest screening seamlessly into our reservation process, allowing us to authenticate guest details in real time across multiple databases. This prevents fraud and unwanted parties. Talk about incredible peace of mind.
Plus, Superhog offers a damage waiver program to cover damages efficiently. You can leverage their damage protection plan that offers unmatched short-term rental protection up to $5 million for all verified bookings.
With Know Your Guest by Superhog, we're scaling our direct bookings without all the worry. Just click the link in our show notes and book your free Superhog demo today.
You're listening to the Thanks for Visiting podcast. We believe hosting with heart is at the core of every short-term rental. With Annette's background in business operation
and Sarah's extensive hospitality management and interior design experience, we have welcomed thousands of guests from over 30 countries, earning us over $1 million and garnering us thousands of five-star reviews.
We love sharing creative ways for your listing to stand out, serve your guests, and be profitable. Each episode, we will have knowledgeable guests who bring value to the short-term rental industry.
Or we will share our stories of our own experiences so you can implement actual improvements to your rentals. Whether you're experienced, new, or nervous to start your own short-term rental, we promise you'll feel right at home. Before we dive into the content, let's hear a word from our sponsor.
Hosting hot tip. You know how we're always on the hunt for awesome pieces for our short-term rentals?
Well, we're going to let you in on our secret weapon. It is Manoan. They have steep discounts on over 100 top brands. Think Wayfair, Article, West Elm, Crate & Barrel, Pollywood, Parachute, Velo. The list goes on and on. But these discounts are for hosts and designers for hosts only.
I had my eye on this awesome coffee table from Wayfair, wanting to give our listing that wow factor, but you know us. We are all about having our numbers dialed in and staying budget friendly.
And that's where Manoan stepped in with an awesome discount. And here's the kicker. Becoming a member is totally free. Yes, I said free. F-R-E-E. No cost to join. No monthly membership. It is completely free. But these discounts are exclusive. You do have to be a host or a designer for hosts.
Once you're a member, all you have to do is head to their site, install their browser extension, which makes shopping so, so simple, and purchase and fill your shopping cart in just a few clicks. And it's not just furniture and decor. Restock your most used items anytime you need to refill your supply area.
Exactly. And the best part, again, no catch. There's no fees, nada. Just major discounts waiting for you. Being a Manoan member is like being a VIP host without breaking the bank.
So head on over to ManoanExperience.com. That's M-I-N-O-A-N experience.com, or just simply click the link in our show notes and sign up and let the savings begin.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back for another great episode. My name is Sarah Karakayan.
I'm Annette Grant, and together we are
Thanks for visiting. Let's kick off this episode like we do every week, and that is sharing one of you amazing hosts who's using our hashtag on Instagram. That's hashtag STR Share Sunday. We'll share you here on the podcast, on Instagram every Sunday, to our entire email list. Annette, who are we sharing this week?
This week, we are sharing at lazy_pines_cabins. And you can find them online at www.lazypinescabins.com. Going to give their direct booking site some love. And Angela and Tracy are dog lovers, and you will see this over and over and over again. And we appreciate Angela because she actually called into our hosting hotline and asked a question also. So Angela, thanks for being a loyal listener and super user. We love when people use the hashtag and call in. One thing that I want to highlight in her Instagram account is if you aren't right now, please go to her account. You can see where she is pinning. You can pin very important or posts that you want to make sure that your followers will always see, or people landing on your page. And I love one of the things that she has pinned. She has this diagram of kind of explaining all four of her cabins, the size, the location, the weather, the yard, and the number of dogs. So she kind of gives you a breakdown in a very, very small area. So it'll help you choose what cabin you should choose. So I just really love this grid. I haven't seen this done before. So check that out. And then the other thing too is Angela is just so passionate about her dogs and other people's dogs. She's very clear throughout all of her advertising that there are no pet fees. And so we salute her for leaning in on you know, how she would like her dogs to be welcomed into the home. She is doing the same. And one last thing I want to note, she has an experience for her pet owners that have to do with them being able to engrave their pet's name on dog tags. She has a rainbow bridge for some of her dogs that have passed away that they can participate in. So it is just a really dog friendly. If you go to her page, which I encourage you to do, please go follow and check out that grid and then check out all of her pet posts. Well done, Angela. Thanks for using the hashtag. Sarah.
Let's go to school.
I know.
Let's go to college. You know, I'd go back.
You would go back. If I could hang out with this guest, I would go back. I think one of my favorite quotes from today's episode is when our guest says, "The right to bear guests." And yeah, exactly what Sarah just did. It didn't make me chuckle, but I just really loved the reference there of the right to bear guests, because it really does, you have a mindset shift when you hear that in parallel to the right to bear arms. So just kind of shows what that debate could be in cities and towns.
Today's guest is Brumby McLeod. He's an associate professor at the College of Charleston School of Business in the Department of Hospitality and Tourism Management.
Our first, I think, true academic.
Love it.
I know. Well, I'm sure if there's been other academics on, I'm sure you're smart, but not in this. I don't think you did a dissertation.
I'm
on
sure
it.
You're smart.
But you didn't tell us you did a dissertation on short-term rentals.
He is a research fellow with the Office of Tourism Analysis and the Riley Center for Livable Communities. The focus of his research is an overnight accommodation with a primary focus on housing, short-term rentals, and tourism. In 2018, Brumby received a U.S. Fulbright scholarship to explore the nightly rental phenomena in Iceland. We met Brumby by way of connection with our good friends over at Rent Responsibly. They are working with Brumby on their State of the Union survey. Thousands of hosts took this survey, and right now, actually, Brumby is going through all the results. Don't fret. We will have Rent Responsibly on and share the results with all of you. But in today's episode with Brumby, he really takes us through the vacation short-term rental experience from 2003 all the way up until now. And we asked him the question, of course, where does he see our industry going? He's so good at remaining neutral. He gets excited seeing everyone's point of views and then putting them together so he can create research and solutions for various aspects of the industry, whether it's small government, whether it's investors themselves. So Brumby's a really cool guy, and we can't wait to dig in with him with you today. Brumby, welcome to the show. We are so excited to have you here today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We want to jump right in and give us a scoop prior to academia. What were you doing, and what led you to studying essentially travel, short-term rentals, overnight accommodations, that whole industry?
And I think the main influence was my childhood, going to stay at second homes. So I grew up in Roswell, Georgia, north of Atlanta. And family had someone in the family had a home down in Ponte Vedra, the island, and maybe an aunt or uncle, a great aunt, great uncle. And then my grandmother built a home in a mountain community called Big Canoe. And so as a child, I was exposed to second homes. And so when I was in school out west at University of Montana, and I decided I really liked college and wanted to think about being a college professor, saw that there was an opportunity to study tourism. And you ultimately have to come up with the topic. And I kept kind of reflecting back to this second home, these second homes I kept visiting. And there was a body of research on second home tourism that I came across while in Montana. And so when I went to study my PhD, I started reading that literature.
Can you give us a time frame of just to kind of root us in, because so many of our listeners, I'm doing air quotes here, listeners are accidental hosts and they just kind of, you know, happened upon it. But you were so intentional about this. What year did you start studying the second home phenomena?
So I went to start my PhD program at University of Nevada, Las Vegas in 2003.
So no Airbnb.
no Airbnb. And I started seeing research on it when I was at University of Montana in 2002.
What was the discussion then? So what?
Yeah, what was the research? What are people talking about?
Well, I remember when I got started the program at UNLV, you know, you're taking mainly research and methodology classes. So it's not like I'm in classes on tourism. I'm in classes on structural equation modeling and qualitative research methods. And so you're in class with economics and business and engineering students and maybe some education students that are all working to become researchers, or at least that's what they're learning about. And so you start thinking about what's your dissertation going to be on, or who's your committee going to be. And I remember approaching a gentleman and asked him if he'd be interested in being on my committee. And he said, well, what are you thinking about studying? And I said, second homes. And he looks at me and goes, what the hell does that have to do with tourism? And that was around 2004.
Really?
And so this idea that it was driving travel, I mean, I knew it was, but it wasn't mainstream. And certainly it wasn't an investment class, right? People had a second home because it was all related to their vacations primarily.
So I know that Airbnb came to the scene in 2008. When did Vrbo come on, Rumbi? Do you know?
Yeah. So when I was actively preparing my dissertation, there was a group raising money to buy a number of websites that were like A1 Vacations, VRBO, vacationrentals.com. And that group was HomeAway.
Uh-huh.
So they had raised the capital to then go buy the websites. Most of the communities that had a large proliferation of vacation rentals, though, that was being managed by the property management companies and the local realtor sites. So they would often have their own website or put together an annual catalog that, you know, advertised their vacation rentals.
Wait, this is brilliant. So I wonder, do you have any of these still? So there would be a physical catalog, let's say it is Sea Island, and it would have all of the homes with kind of all of their breakdown. Kind of, I guess they still do that in real estate magazines, but they would publish these and send these out to potential guests.
Yeah. When I was on my Fulbright in Iceland, the unions did that. So often there would be small rural cottage kind of neighborhoods that were built out as cottages, and the unions would profile each of those homes and they would be for rent. And they still produce some of those catalogs.
So what was your actual dissertation topic then?
So I was interested in why someone would make their home available to others and to rent. So I called it the willingness to host, was the concept we call it a construct that I was coming up with. And you don't have a lot of resources. So I was piggybacking on a study that my colleagues, my teachers were doing in Costa Rica. They were doing an intercept of over 20,000 people at the airport in Costa Rica and their two airports. And if someone said they owned a home there, they threw them out of the study. So the people that got thrown out of the study then went to my study because they were living abroad but owned a home. And so I was trying to get at how the home was being utilized and how often it was rented or if it was rented at all. So that was the,
This is fascinating. What were you trying to prove though? Was it they have an affinity for hosting folks, or maybe they couldn't quite afford the second home and they wanted to offset that? Did you have a thesis that you were trying to prove, or are you just trying to collect data?
We were looking at the relationship of personal attachment, place attachment. So people's, how they identify to the place and why that place, they were dependent on that place. So kind of a two-dimension structure of place attachment. And then how that led to the willingness to host. So if the attachment was stronger, the willingness to host would be stronger. And ultimately, you're trying to conduct your first significant research project and get approved by your researchers. And we later on published a paper on the concept of willingness to host. But as you know, 2008 and beyond, the word hosting became something that was a pretty normal topic, but this idea of second home tourism is far outweighed now by people purposely investing in you know, it's an investment class, the short-term rental.
Well, but
short-term rental wasn't really used.
Right. What was, during the initial dissertation and research, what was the through line that you saw through the willingness to host? What is something that was shocking to you or interesting or something that you weren't, you were probably one of the first ones to study it. So what was something that you were seeing again and again with the willingness to host?
That they weren't being rented.
Oh, what do you mean?
So there's willingness to host, but there wasn't a willingness to rent?
Yeah, to share, which we still see today. So imagine visiting friends and relatives. So your friends are coming or you have the beach house and say, yeah, you can use it in the next 2 weeks. It wasn't actively in a rental pool.
Okay, so they were willing to host, but not accept money for the exchange there.
Yeah, and I had not really thought through, like at that time in the research process and where things were, I was just trying to get about, were they willing to share the home? And so hosting didn't really mean rent to me. I didn't ask it really that way.
Oh, see, that's how ingrained it is in our head. Hosting, we're like hosting for money. You were just trying to say willingness to host anyone that was outside of like not their core family.
Yeah, would you let others use it?
Okay.
Now we still see that today heavily, particularly if it's someone's second home that they use. So if we see that they use it, there's often a time that they share it without a charge. And a lot of our companies like Key Data that collect statistics, a lot of times you'll see the back out of friends of the owner, right? There's mm-hmm. a level of occupancy that's not part of the paid occupancy.
So then your journey then takes you into what, Brumby? What was your next step after your dissertation? What was the next move for you?
Yeah, so that was kind of grandiose. I mean, looking at a country and that was my sample. And then there were clearly where the sample was coming from, where these homes were. They were centered around little tourist regions or second home communities of expats or Ticos that came back. Ticos are Costa Ricans that came back to their, you know, favorite spot in their country, but they were living abroad. But it started to become rather clear to me when I moved. I took a job at University of South Carolina. I was still studying it, but I wasn't in a community that had a lot of second homes. But when I moved to Charleston and took the job at College of Charleston, that's when my research really, you know, I started to study it full time and regularly. And it made sense because I was in a community that had a number of different towns, you know, cities that were taking different approaches. And I think what I did get out of Costa Rica, though, is that it really has to be looked at a local level, a neighborhood level, a community level, even maybe one side of the community versus the other. So it might be the, you know, if it's an island, it might be the side that's on the water, not necessarily the homes in the middle, and started looking at this as a local tourism issue or local jurisdiction challenge.
Okay. And then you're in Charleston. What year is this? And what's happening in the second home industry? Has Airbnb been introduced? And what does that do to your research and to your day to day?
So for me, when I arrived, the first thing I looked at is how are they describing the market? And it was being described by hotel performance. And so I was trying to get the attention of the DMO, which is Explore Charleston, and the county and city governments say, is this accurate? Are we really telling the full story? And so I worked to quantify what was going on and, you know, reached out to companies that like Destametrics, who had been like measuring vacation rental performance in the mountains for a number of years. So this was early August 2010. And saying, listen, if we looked at what's paid in on tax revenue from lodging taxes, the hotels explain like less than half of it. And so we're not telling the full story. And so then I started working to create measures so these beach communities and those doing vacation rentals could share the story. And so if you looked at something like a Kiwa Island, you know, they've consistently had over 1,300 vacation rentals for over a decade. And they only had one hotel at the time, 255 rooms. So, you know, they wanted to tell that story and needed to tell that story. And then if they looked at things like their business licensing, vacation rental was almost all their licensing. If it wasn't because they were operating vacation rental, it's because someone was coming to maintain the vacation rental. So all their business licensing, you know, probably 90%+ was related to the vacation rental business, and whether that was painting the homes or repairing the homes or managing the homes or the real estate involved.
What were your thoughts when Airbnb came on the scene and started to be more mainstream, and not just second homes, but renting your primary home or a portion of your home? Did that completely disrupt what you've been studying when it's no longer second homes, it's primary homes and that investment community?
Well, because I was focused on communities, it showed up pretty early, particularly in the urban environment and the residential neighborhoods that weren't beach communities. I mean, we're dealing with decades of vacation rentals in these islands like Isle of Palm, Sullivan's Island, Kiwa Island, Folly Beach, and the ski communities were the same, right? They're like, this isn't new. What was new was the urban environment and its proliferation into what we would not consider a vacation rental home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I watched that happen in Charleston, and the regulations, even though we're in the same county, each one of these towns has a different approach to how they want to engage in the short-term rental business, or if they want to at all.
How many other professors, like how many other people, does every school have this hospitality tourism specialty like you in short-term rentals, or are you kind of far and few between? I mean, Sarah and I, and we'll let the listeners know, like we did have a conversation with Brumby like before this, but we're like, oh my gosh, she's truly the first academic that we've had on the show. We've had people that have studied it because they want to like fight for their right to short-term rent in their area, but not as their profession. So how many other Brumbies are there out there in the U.S.?
There's only one Brumby, but
there's one Brumby, but there's a lot of ways to study this. And I call it a lens, right? So how are you looking at this? And so anyone in housing, you know, there's not one at every university by any means, but if someone chose to study housing, you have to look at non-primary residents as a class, because I mean, that's probably the majority of homes are not primary residents now, especially if you look at multifamily. And then if it's not primary residents, then what is that asset doing? What's the inventory doing? And so there's people in economics and housing, political science, housing policy.
Okay.
Tourism space, it's not uncommon now. Matter of fact, I'm getting ready to go to a conference, Travel and Tourism Research Association, and there'll be people presenting a research on vacation rentals. And then you can always, you know, look at if you're into tourism spending and economics, it's like, well, does someone in a vacation rental spend differently than someone in a hotel? And so anyway, they're I'm not alone, but in the beginning, I think it was, you know, it was unusual. But now, I mean, I have a colleague who is a prolific researcher, and a lot of his studies are specifically about Airbnb. I don't tend to use the words like Airbnb and Vrbo. I think of those as brands of distribution mm-hmm. channels. And so it's like saying Kleenex instead of facial tissue. I tend to talk about the unit. And how's the unit being used, which is kind of stale. But Airbnb is definitely the Kleenex, the facial tissue.
Do you say short-term rental or vacation rental? Or do you just use overnight stays? Okay.
And often that's defined by a number, right? And there's sometimes those numbers conflict. There might be a state law, that's a state statute that's different than the city ordinance. So sometimes we see differences at levels of government. And then you might have a neighborhood association or property owner that doesn't allow it at all.
Right.
So I'm fascinated by the conflicts and the layers of government and quasi-government. I think that's probably one of my favorite places to study right now, because it's just within one region, I see these differences. You know, we have an island here called Sullivan's Island that almost 2.5 decades ago banned short-term rentals. And it's an island, right? And it's probably one of the most pricey zip codes, but they still have like just under 40 vacation rentals left from the grandfathered in. But the island right next to them, which is just across the a breach of about 100 yards, they have over 1,200 vacation rentals. And so I think it's neat how these communities decide what they want to be.
You mentioned on our first call with you, and I think our listeners would be interested in this, there were two topics I want to go over. One is you were sharing with us in some of your research, like where vacation rentals are absolutely vital to the community. And then there was another one, though, that you had mentioned where it's decimating the communities. What are you seeing when there becomes that, like, you know, too many vacation rentals in a smaller area?
You know, I think those are the two extreme positions. I think of housing as like food. We actually have plenty of places to sleep, but our distribution of it is the problem. And so you have a number of communities where their primary residence, maybe for a small number, and then the rest are second homes. And then it's, what are those second homes doing? Are they sitting empty, or are they part of the rental process? And so when we did a group of us did a study on mountain ski towns, and we looked at something like Park City that had about 10,000 units in it. And under 2,000 of those were like primary residences. And then that meant the other 8,000 were in the kind of second homes. But of those second homes, maybe 1,800 to 2,000 of those were long-term rentals. So that leaves us with about 6,000. There were only 2,000 vacation rental licenses. So that suggests that 4,000 units are staying open, you know, and sitting there, you know, just for the homeowner use or the friends of the homeowners. And so that's kind of one example. But, when we look at our housing and we quantify it, and you can ask, I like to ask the question, what is our housing doing? Like, where do your residents sleep? Where do your guests sleep? Where does your workforce sleep? And I think where your workforce sleep right now is probably one of the hottest questions. Are we pushing? There's competition for that housing. And often we're providing that housing to the highest payer, and the highest payer is going to be the short-term stay.
How do we combat that, though? Because I know in ski towns, that's a huge hot topic. And even in the beach towns, people are driving an hour, hour and a half, you know, to get to the property. What is the solution for that? Yeah, because I don't think the workforce is also staying on a ski in, ski out property. Like that's where I can voice my opinion is,
yep,
freeing up those homes isn't going to help the workforce housing issues. What are you offering to those complaints or to that issue that is happening?
Yeah, zoning and investment in housing. Zoning that, and you see that, deed-restricted housing. Problem is it's we're late to the game in many of these scenarios. And so the cost of land and development. But I also think there's a natural solution to the market. So if you look at something like Park City, you see a lot of development outside of the city, right? Just outside the city limits. You see other towns appearing that are bedroom communities. And that's kind of the natural cycle of cities. That's what happens, right? The cost goes up and then new cities develop. And so some of this, I think, is a natural economic cycle or natural development cycle of cities. But I think for the local government, it's zoning. You know, what's interesting about local government is often the second homeowner they can't vote because they can only vote in their primary, you know, their primary residence. So I think plan unit developments where there's homeowners association and property owners associations, those protect the property rights of owners that might get voted out. So at least they get to vote, right? But if you're in a community where you're a second homeowner and it's not in a HOA, you don't have a vote. We're seeing community swing. We just saw last year, Folly Beach. When I first started doing work for Folly Beach, they had about 450 vacation rentals out of 2,200 homes. And last summer, it was over 1,300 vacation rentals for 2,200 homes. And they like, that's enough, right? And so they put in a cap and they'll work through that. But a lot of those homeowners, if they're second homeowners, didn't get a vote on that.
Sarah.
What?
I want you to take a guess how much we are going to spend this year on Airbnb and Vrbo fees.
Oof. I feel like I should know this number off the top of my head.
It's okay. Just make a guess.
16, 17,000?
Wrong. Over
$50,000.
What?
Yes, I'm on Hostly's direct bookings ROI calculator right now, and I plugged in our stats, and yes, based on the number of bookings we anticipate for this year, that's how much Airbnb is going to charge us for fees.
That's crazy.
I know, but I've got some good news for you. Since we use Hostly as our property management software, the calculator is letting us know if we continue to improve our direct booking strategy, we can save over $15,000 per year.
Wow, that is good news. Plus, we know this. When we make it our goal to improve our direct bookings with Hostly, we will have more control over our cancellation policies, guest database, and our overall branding differentiation in this crazy growing industry.
Yes. Plus our bottom line.
Yeah.
So listeners, please give Hostly's direct booking ROI calculator a try for yourself. And we bet you'll be excited to learn more about Hostly's award-winning property management software and their integrated, built-in, out-of-the-box, completely customizable direct booking site for your hosting business.
And thanks for visiting, listeners. Get $100 off when they use code TFV100 at checkout. That's right. Use code TFV100 when signing up for Hostly's property management software to get $100 off.
You also, in our first conversation, you're going to have to explain this, like re-explain this to it. It was interesting how you were sharing with us this thought process on, you know, if you have a friend or a family member stay in your home, like the usage of your home and who gets to dictate that. Like, why aren't we, so if I have my sister or brother come stay with me, why aren't they paying me or why aren't paying taxes on that? Do you remember that like scenario that you said? Like,
yeah,
when does it stop crossing the line of being able to have overnight guests?
I kind of have these two extremes to, because I try to play, you know, I try to listen to the viewpoints and try to understand it. And I think one is this property rights, do I have the right to bear guests? And
that's what it is, right to bear guests.
Yes, yeah, right to bear guests. And is that a fundamental right? In some states think it is, particularly if you're home, right? So if you're boarding or allowing someone. And then I also think about kind of the other extreme, and like just because I have beer and liquor doesn't mean in my house doesn't mean I can open a bar, right? There's license and things like that. So there's kind of these two extremes, like constitutional extremes of how you might look at this. But, you know, I was thinking of, I think what you're referring to is the idea of the sharing. And so let's say my friend says, brother, you can go down to Folly Beach and enjoy the week. You know, it's on us, right? If that house is renting for $5,000-$6,000 a week, shouldn't I get a 1099 that says I got it? I just received a $6,000 gift, and so anyway, those are just some of the scenarios I play with in this debate.
People, you probably get in some heated debates. Okay, who are the people that you see are so passionate against the right to bear guests? What's their beef?
I think it's communities that are dealing with affordability. And although short-term rental isn't the cause, it's related. And so if short-term rental is penetrating your multifamily housing, it's appearing in apartments and things like that, and your workforce is having to commute in far, and you know, the people tend to get emotional. And then the other is the person that's next to an Airbnb. You got me to say Airbnb, but next to a vacation rental that drives them nuts. But I always drive a neighbor who's like always has stuff in his garage and friends over. I was like, you can get a long-term resident that brings those same pieces. But I someone who's affected by it consistently and annoyed, and they can get real passionate. I do not get in heated debates, though. I just nod my head and agree, because I've heard so many viewpoints now.
For you, it's probably like gold to hear all sides and all thoughts. Brummy, my question to you is, there seems to also be a change in the way people are living in general. Digital nomads, people who don't want a primary home and they do want the flexibility of living in any town. And we're seeing it as, you know, quote unquote, housing providers. It's really big in the midterm rental space. You can say that you host nurses. But in my experience, it's been a lot of people just, I want to hang out in Columbus for 6 weeks, and then I'm going to go off and hang out in another city. How has that infiltrated your studies at all, or impacting housing in general?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing responses on some of our survey studies about the midterm stay and how long that is. There's companies starting that are trying to get better utilization of inventory. Right now, one that comes to mind on the affordable housing side is CoLife, and they're basically taking empty bedrooms, right? It's kind of that the food and hunger scenario. Like everyone who's had a college kid move out, right? Their kids have gone off to college, has an empty bedroom, and those empty bedrooms add up quickly, particularly in suburban neighborhoods. You know, how do you get those utilized? I think that the housing is just flexible. And I think with our workforce and moving and transitioning, and you made me think of something. I remember one of my jobs coming out of school, I worked for a company called Waste Management, which was a massive company, but I worked for their environmental remediation division. And so I would be on projects and I stayed in those extended stay hotels for weeks at a time. And so there's a lot of people in that scenario that are temporarily assigned or transitioning or doing contract work. And home ownership's expensive and it can be boring being stuck in one place. So I think we're seeing products, though, or at least I'm seeing products in community, though, that look a lot more like purpose-built vacation rentals.
Mm-hmm.
And they're being built with pre-approval to be, yeah, okay, then they're a hotel, right? But they're offering the residential product. And so you asked me what I called this. I actually called it residential short-term rental for a long time, because you know that's really what the difference is between the other transient accommodations. You know, a bed in a box at the hotel with a bathroom, bed in a bath. You know, now it's a residential product.
Do you encounter the hotel industry? And we tell the story often that Sarah and I met at a city council meeting here in Columbus, that because they were wanting to put some really strict restrictions on the amount of nights that we could have a residential short-term rental. And I feel like that was just the hotels had infused a lot of dollars to make that happen. What do you see with hotels and short-term rentals? I know they're moving into the space, but do you work with hotels a lot? Do you hear a lot of noise from hotels wanting to clamp down the amount of short-term rentals?
Well, I mean, we see that in cities. I mean, Vegas is one that's been very anti-short-term rental, but our largest operators of vacation rentals are hotels, right? So if you're a Key Island and you have the Sanctuary, you also have 600 plus vacation rentals in your portfolio. And your portfolio has an advantage over the other vacation rental companies because you provide them access to the resort amenities. Wild Dunes is that way. And so I think in this market, I didn't see that because they're all members of the Convention Visitors Bureau and they're big operators of vacation rentals. But I have seen that and read about it and talked to people in New York. I've had groups that want me to do a study for them, but it's very clearly to support a position they hold. And I don't do that type of research.
That's fair enough. And talking about research, I do want to just mention that we had the pleasure of meeting Brumby through our partners Rent Responsibly. And can you share how you met Rent Responsibly and kind of how that relationship has grown over time?
I met Dave Krause through, there was a lot of advocacy going on in Charleston when the short-term rental had become really a battle around HomeAway and Airbnb being in the urban districts of Charleston. I had designed a forum with some folks, Dave Krause being one of them, and we did a public listening session in our public library in downtown Charleston. And that's how we met. And then I ended up doing some work with him when he founded NoiseAware.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And did a neat study with them on noise across all sorts of different housing units that did not show short-term rentals being louder. Then we found that the long-term rental in general, just because of the number of people consistently coming out in and out, were. But, you know, that was our sample, and we put the devices in a number of units. And I think the loudest one we had was someone that had gotten in a political debate around the election in 2016.
Makes sense.
And then the other was
tracks for sure.
Someone had put equipment in to dry out a unit that had gotten super wet from a hurricane. And so noise comes from all sorts of places. But that's how I met Dave, and we've we did the 2021 State of the Industry study with them. We're just now finished this year's study, State of the Industry. And we also did a local government component nationwide.
Ooh.
We're looking at several thousand participated in that one.
Yeah, we're hoping to have Dave on the podcast to share with us and our listeners the results of that.
Yeah. And if listeners, if you didn't get to participate this year, these are things to be on the lookout for. Brumby, that's what I want to ask if you could offer. Like, what do you see the best use of hosts' time to be their own advocates? You know, like you're in these cities, you see what's happening. How can we, like, what's best that we can do to take care of our second homes, to take care of our investment portfolio so that we can still have the right to bear guests? Do you have any advice for us? What would you offer to our listeners?
It's engagement in the local community. And then I think what I've seen Rent Responsibly do in that industry is it's a legitimate industry, right? There's a legitimate use of an investment asset, be a good owner and good neighbor and stay involved in your local community. And there's certainly an economic benefit to the community from it. From almost all of these homes are paying a higher property tax rate, but they're not sending children to the school and things like that. So that's a plus. They're all collecting the lodging accommodation taxes. And often they have additional taxes that they're allowed to add in, such as extra hospitality or beach renourishment, things like that. And so I think being a legitimate operator, and I think you're going to have to be involved. Their communities are going to be talking about caps for a lot of them. And I don't think that's a bad thing, but how are they coming to that number? And aware and getting operators that aren't following the rules. Many communities have had rules for years. They weren't aware that they needed to be applied or followed.
Do you think you'll see kind of like, I know, let's say our area, for example, like liquor license, really hard to come by. There's only X amount per zip codes and it's just for sale and like sale to the highest bidder. Have you seen the short-term rental licenses kind of have an underground selling at all? Have you encountered that?
Well, I knew that was a problem in some research about in 2017-18 when we were seeing caps and swings in communities. But I've seen some really good local government policy. So, for instance, community called Mount Pleasant, they started putting in, they had a cap. And of course, the first year everyone rushed and the cap was filled. But then they realized we need to only allow these licenses to people that prove they're renting. And so they put in a requirement of at least, I think it was either 24 to 30 days that you had to show evidence, at least four different tenants, four different, you know, guests across four different stays. And that kept it really balanced. And then I think those are good practices, you know, how you administer the licenses. But, you know, I spend a lot of my time with local governments because that's kind of where I've enjoyed the space. And so they're sharing best practices and they want to know what's working. And, you know, they different types of towns, from beach communities, river communities, downtown communities, neighborhoods. I love some of the zoning where a neighborhood chooses to allow it. We have a really unique setup in Charleston. There's about 62 neighborhoods, what we would call old neighborhoods. And one of them is called Cannonborough. And that's the only neighborhood in around 2012 that said we want vacation rentals. And they've seen this phenomenal economic boost in their community with the best restaurants, the most foot traffic. And their rule was pretty simple. It had to be zoned commercial and that already, and then that unit could be converted. So it attracted a lot of investment that was long-term college rentals, that four roommates, six cars, and that's kind of gone away. And it's created a really neat revitalized community.
Interesting. Brumby, to say your favorite word, Airbnb, we've tried to use short-term rental or furnished rental, but in our marketing efforts, trying to find more listeners and more people to engage with us, you have to say Airbnb. It's like what it is. But anyway, there's a hashtag that I'm sure you've heard of, Airbnbust, where post, you know, COVID, where people could only drive to get away, quote unquote, get away destinations. And the hotels were also an area of uncertainty in terms of health issues. But now things seem to be normalizing, air quotes. What do you think the future is of short-term rentals? Is there, and if you don't want to state maybe what your personal opinion is, what do you think the the masses are talking about? Like, where do you think this industry will be in the next few years? Do you think it'll continue to be an option that travelers want and need? Do you think it's going to regress at all? Any thoughts in that area?
I see the options of transient rentals being there for a long time. I think the product types will catch up, purpose-built. I see it being issues in communities for a while, but I think there's a saturation that's occurred. You look at something like in Asheville, and there's just so many.
Yeah,
there's got to be a point that you know, people are like, yeah, you know, it's not worth it, or they realize there's a lot more skill involved in managing it and marketing it to make it make sense. And I think we'll see that occur when the housing market adjusts. Right now, we'll see. It'll still be there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Interesting. And then my last question is, Brumby, do you have it, since we do have an academic on the show, is there a book, an article, anything that you would guide our readers or ourselves to that you just think is of interest, or something that you encourage all willingness hosts to read, to consume?
Well, the academic stuff sits behind like subscriptions to journals. So Annals of Tourism Research, Journal of Travel Research.
Yeah, those don't show up on my credit card.
Yeah,
those are not
bestsellers.
Yeah, they're not. And just access to one article, if you don't have it through your library, it's not a popular read, any of them.
Fair enough.
But I think many of the classics around real estate investment are worthy reads, because it is, at the end of the day, this is it's a real estate asset with an intended use. It's a shorter stay, but I mean, it's hospitality and it's real estate that coming together. And I think the entrepreneurial side, which is what made this so attractive. My biggest worry in this space has been the institutional investor.
Mm.
They are heavily invested in the real estate investment trusts in the long term. And if they choose to do some short term or when they decide to start selling, what's that going to look like? But I think any of the real estate investment books, I'm trying to think of the Millionaire Investor. I think that those are some of my favorite. And all you're changing is what's the term of that rent and how short and how much and the seasonality. But I think those are all classics.
Cool. You brought up an interesting point, the institutional buyers. We've seen a couple of them come to our market, into Columbus, Brumby. And around 2021, 22, they like wanted to come on the podcast and share about their efforts. But Annette and I were, you know, not fans, because our listeners are independent hosts. They own and operate their own rentals. And so like, this is not going to resonate. And then in 2023, they fall apart. You know,
they're gone. Or they've pivoted their entire business. And it's fascinating to us because they're just about the numbers.
I have to think it's, especially with an institutionalized buyer, the operations alone, it's not as easy as just hiring a cleaner. And because that's how they would pitch it to us on our quick calls, our quick Zoom calls, or just getting to know each other. So, we'll just hire some cleaners and some maintenance guys and buy all these single family homes and boom, like we're going to nail this. We're going to buy all of Columbus. And then they, you know, fall apart a couple of years later. But what are your thoughts on buyers?
I was referring to the real estate investment trust that, you know, specialize in owning homes, mm-hmm. and not that they're in the short term.
Oh, okay.
Per se. So, a little bit different reference than yours, but there's a lot of people out there competing. I think as long as the challenge or the problem, I think that attracted all this in the first place is that real estate is our most lucrative engagement. Like you and I go to work and, you know, we get a W-2 and it's like, before we see the income, we've paid 200 out of our 1,000 into the system. Real estate doesn't require that. We get to bring the revenue, spend it, and then tell them what's left. If you notice, most of your local business licenses, they tax you on the revenue, not after expenses, right? And so I think we're going to see more of that pressure. But as long as the real estate is lucrative and we get to treat income differently than we do from wage income, I think it'll always be an attractive place to spend our time. And I don't see that changing, because so much of the local engagement in these communities. I mean, how many times a city council member is a realtor?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You see, or a mayor. I see it all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
And they're like, they're not going to change it.
Well, so. And that's like, maybe this should have been our first question, but we'll make it our last. Do you yourself have a second home? Are you a willing host, or have you decided
today,
that?
Today, I don't.
Okay.
Not today, but I
you
have.
Used to. You have. Okay. I know at the very beginning you mentioned I potentially like an aunt or great aunt, like Sea Island. The willingness to host there, was that them hosting family at that time when you were like doing your dissertation, those family trips? Do you ever remember your parents exchanging money for any of these trips?
No, I don't ever recall them paying. I mean, Big Canoe was my grandmother's and Ponte Vedra was my grandmother's like cousin or uncle.
Okay.
And Sea Island was a uncle that no way, there was no money. And even in Montana, it was, you know, going to Big Sky or Big Mountain, or it was like girlfriend or a friend. And, you know, we'd stay and play and go up to the lake. And it was all visiting friends and relatives. Okay. That's what second home tourism really was about initially.
Are you open, Brumby, if our listeners wanted to reach out or learn more about your research, how could they do that?
Yeah, I think email is probably best, and they could reach out to me. Awesome. At the College of Charleston, where I am.
Okay, we'll make sure to put that in the show notes. We're so thankful for your time. We feel like after our last conversation with you, we were like, we just felt smarter.
Yeah, instantly smarter. We're now,
we have the academic on our side, but we're really excited. Listeners, we are going to share in the future the amazing study that Brumby did in alongside Rent Responsibly. So stay tuned for that. And if you participated in it, thank you very much. But Brumby, thanks for your time today. This was awesome.
Yes, thank
you. Sarah and Annette, I appreciate it.
With that, I am Sarah Karakayan.
I'm Annette Grant, and together we are
Thanks for visiting.
Talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Thanks for Visiting podcast. Head on over to the show notes for additional information about today's episode. And please hit that subscribe button and leave us a review. Awesome reviews help us bring you awesome content. Thanks for tuning in, and we look forward to hanging out with you next week. Ever wonder what it would be like to have personalized guidance from Annette and me? Imagine achieving the same incredible results we helped Amy achieve, increasing her overall revenue by a staggering 187% by diving into her biz numbers. Or perhaps you'd love to boost your hosting business like Miranda, who added a fantastic $10,000 by refining her pet policy. Well, here's a scoop. There's only one way to get that one-on-one support from Annette, myself, our expert coaches, and our industry pros is by attending our on-demand workshop. Trust us, it's worth it. During the workshop, we'll make an offer to all of our attendees to join our membership. Once you're a part of our exclusive membership, you'll gain access to our elite community of hosts in our private Facebook group. This is where the magic truly happens. Members are engaging in discussions about their business numbers, occupancy rates, how to handle guest challenges, and providing unwavering support to one another. Plus, we will have live coaching calls to help you dive deeper into portfolio growth, team building, marketing, and so much more. Don't wait any longer. Head on over to www.hostmasterclass.com right now to secure your spot and embark on this exciting journey with us. That's www.hostmasterclass.com. Trust us, you won't regret it.